This is Audible.
Better Listen presents Reality, Art, and Illusion, Part 1, with Alan Watts.
I'm going to start by talking to you about the foundation idea underlying the whole of this seminar, which is the Hindu, Buddhist, that is to say Indian, idea of the world as illusion, which they call Maya, M-A-Y-A. This is one of the most rich ideas that has ever been thought by the mind of man, because it has such a great multiplicity of meanings. When Hinduism is reported in little textbooks on comparative religion and encyclopedia articles, this is one point on which almost all the scholars are either completely misleading or very incomplete. Because there is a general impression has circulated in the West that the Hindus live in a very, very hot country, have very little to eat, and live an absolutely miserable life. And therefore this affects the brain in a certain way. The heat makes the world seem like a mirage, makes it seem rather unreal. And the extremely low standard of living makes life intolerable, and so they would just as soon believe that it isn't real, that it all has a dreamlike quality, and that the highest ideal to which man can aspire is to escape altogether from this sort of physical existence, which they call samsara, the round of birth and death, and to disappear into a state of rather diffuse consciousness wherein the individuality vanishes and one is simply suspended forever, or in a kind of timeless time, in an infinite ocean of faintly luminous mauve jello. Now, this is all terribly misleading. This isn't the point at all. And so I want to start then by telling you the many, many things that the word Maya actually means. First of all, the foundation of the word is the Sanskrit root M-A-T-R. And that has as its original meaning, so far as we can trace it back, the idea of measuring or laying out the foundations for a building. And you can see how from that root, M-A-T-R, we derive many, many words through Greek and Latin in the English language connected with measurement. Metric, meter, matrix, matter, as in the saying, does it matter? Does it measure up to anything? And so fundamental to the concept of the world illusion is then the idea of measurement, of equating the realities of the physical world with certain systems of numbering, whether it be so many spans of the hand, so many feet, so many paces, so many bongs on a drum, or whatever you've got to be your regular model, your regular system. For the whole idea of measurement is to find an equation between the physical world and something regular, that is to say, with a ruler. Because you see, the physical world is fundamentally wiggly. We don't notice this very much if we live in towns and if we live in ordinary houses, because we build our streets and our homes so as to seem to be non-wiggly. And so we are confronted with tables and chairs and walls and window frames, and we get a sense of non-wiggly reality. And so then we are also always in conflict with wiggliness. We try, for example, not to let the stars seem to be disordered, but to organize them into constellations. The constellations, of course, aren't there. There are no strings joining those stars which constitute the Big Dipper. Seen from another point of view in space, they wouldn't look like a Dipper at all. Actually, those stars happen to be fairly close to each other in space. But sometimes a member of a constellation could very well be an entirely different galaxy, millions of light years away. But we like to do this, and even I once read something that I never believed any human being had ever thought. But during the 18th century, when Western man had a peculiar passion for symmetrical order, somebody wrote an essay saying that the stars had been very poorly disposed, and that if they had been arranged in geometrical patterns, it would have been far more consistent with the divine reason than this haphazardly scattered affair. Our world is wiggly. All of us are wiggly objects. Trees are, rocks are, clouds are, waters are, the outlines of islands, and so on. It's all wiggly. And so in that sense, the universe is rather like an enormous Rorschach plot. Now, a foundation of artistic creation is to see things in blots. For example, if you examine the animal paintings in the caves of Lascaux, which are probably the earliest art forms in existence, it is apparent that the painters of those images first looked at the rock, at its contours and at the smudges and various changes of color in it, and saw the animals and creatures that they painted, just as you might see something in a Rorschach plot. And then they brought it out. Leonardo da Vinci spoke of his using his imagination on a dirty old wall in which he could see landscapes and battles and all kinds of things. And there was a very great Zen painter in China in the Song Dynasty who used to paint as follows. He'd get very drunk, and then he'd got long hair, and he'd dip his hair in ink, and then he'd wave his head over a piece of paper. Then when he had sobered up a little, he'd look at this and do a Rorschach blot on it, and he would see a landscape which could be brought out for all to see by just a few extra touches of the brush. And you see, by that method you create a gorgeous landscape. So this curious ability of the mind of man to pick out significant things in any kind of a wudge is what we call consciousness. Conscio. The basic root in Latin means con, together with scio, to know. To know together. And so from the root scio is connected, you see, with cutting. Science is the same root. And schism, see? It's the same word, to cut. To cut things up into bits, to recognize, to pick out what is significant from what is not, because conscious attention as it exists in man is a kind of radar or a kind of spotlight whose function is to warn the whole organism of significant changes in the environment. If things don't change, consciousness goes to sleep. It gets bored. But the moment anything changes, consciousness notes it at once. That is why our attention is one or captured by a moving object rather than still backgrounds, by easily enclosed and recognizable figures as distinct from vague and diffuse spaces. Although, as a matter of fact, our organism responds to everything that is happening in the environment. But consciousness only notices those things that are thought to be significant. So then, consciousness is the constantly active in trying to make sense and pick out the significant separate bits of a wiggly and fundamentally bitless and thingless universe. And that is one of the meanings of Maya. So, for example, if we have some wiggles, like that, that immediately creates something problematic for us to describe. How can we say anything exactly about that shape? How can we deal with it? Well, the answer is to deal with that shape, which is essentially wiggly, we've got to measure it in some way. There are various ways of doing that. For example, we might refer to certain significant elements in the shape. This can be interpreted either as a promontory or an inlet, whichever one you want. But it seems to be a thing. We can catch hold of that. It's something that sticks out like a nose. Or here's another one, you see. We can mention that. Or we can liken this to certain other things we've seen and say, well, at the point where there's a pear-shaped inlet, there's something significant. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it, which is more exact and more scientific, and which we use for purposes of navigation and also for plotting the stars, is to superimpose over the wiggly shape a uniform pattern, and the fundamental one that we use is, of course, the grid. This. You see? Now superimpose that over the wiggliness on cellophane. And then we can number the spaces down and the spaces along. And we can say this point is number one down and two across, and so give every point a number on our grid, see? And that begins to give us an accurately describable, but nonetheless somewhat caricaturish version of the wiggle. Imagine for a moment, you see, if you examine a newspaper photograph under a magnifying glass, you will find that it is an amalgamation of dots, some light and some dark. In other words, the whole thing has been reduced to a sort of pointillist amalgamation of bits. And under the magnifying glass, this doesn't look at all like the thing, like the human face, for example, that is supposed to be represented. But put away the magnifying glass, look at it from a distance, and it approximates to the human face that you recognize. Now, in a way, all conscious knowledge does that to the world. It reproduces it in terms of some kinds of bits. Words are bits. We arrange words in lines so as to describe events. But we've got a limited number of words that we use, the words in the dictionary, and they are the bits. And words, in turn, are composed of letters. And these are again, the bits. Or much more so when, for example, we transmit television, what is actually coming into our set is a series of impulses, of bits, in certain rhythms. And these, when they affect the television tube, do more of this kind of newspaper jazz on the screen. And so in that way, a picture is arranged, but again in terms of little bits. So also, you see, this was all related to the fundamental way in which, from the earliest times, the study of physics approached nature. From Democritus on, the physicist wanted to know what are the fundamental bits out of which everything is made. And so they thought at first there were atoms, the square ones were for the element of earth, because cubes would all hang together, whereas water would be made up of balls, because it flows, you see, and doesn't stay put, and so on. Fire was made of pyramids and so on. I forget what air was made of. But they wanted to analyze it. And that is because consciousness itself is an analytical faculty. Consciousness is a bright light which illuminates the world one bit at a time in series. So that is one fundamental meaning of Maya. The illusion that the world consists of separate things, which can be isolated from each other and regarded as being independent. Now, that is a colossal illusion. It's a very useful illusion, but it simply isn't so. But it looks as if it was so, because we are so accustomed to looking at it that way. You see, as a matter of fact, we've all been kind of hoaxed by our culture, by the way we've been brought up into looking at the world in this way, and to picking out those things which the culture has told us are important, and ignoring the things which it doesn't think are important. Now, for example, most people are completely unaware of space. Space means where there isn't anything at all. There may be air, but you can't see air, and you can only feel it if you move very quickly. So space is nothing. It's not important. And so we tend, you see, to be unconscious of the field, the area, the setting, the background, the space in which so-called things and events happen. And so to pretend that things and events are not influenced by their space. But every architect knows that space is immensely important. That the kind of room you live in, the kind of house you move around in, influences your behavior enormously. Just as the frame makes all the difference to the picture. I'm thinking, for example, of photography. Where does the photographer frame the subject? How does he shoot it? How does he sight it? And then when he's developed the print, where does he cut the edges? Upon how he does that depends the whole significance of his picture. So we could say then it is a maya, an illusion, that we all imagine ourselves to be living inside our skins, separated from the rest of the cosmos. We've been taught to ignore this enormously significant relationship. Because if we ignore it, we can play the game called Who Started It? And it's who is responsible, who shall we praise and who shall we blame for things being thus and so. I was given a riddle the other day. I'm not going to go through the whole riddle. It's a complicated story of a woman who got murdered, and because she had an assignation with a lover and so on and so on, a whole lot of people, and the husband, the lover, the friend, the woman. They asked me, who was responsible? And I said, well, this isn't the question. The whole situation is responsible, because the parts that everybody play in the thing are defined by the other people. You can't have them playing these parts unless they're all in relation in a common group. So it's the group, if you might say, as a whole, that is responsible. And to play that the individual members of it are responsible is a game, an illusion. And note, please, that the word illusion is related to the Latin ludere,
of which one part is lusus, the perfect, ludere, to play. So playing that, we don't go with our environments, our surroundings, that is to say, the whole cosmos in which we are discovered, is a big game. You can do lots of things with it. But we're all going around unconscious of this marvelous interdependence between what we call ourselves on the one hand and what we call the universe on the other. And therefore, don't notice that, as a matter of fact, our real self is the whole cosmos. We've forgotten that. That was rapidly expunged from our minds in very early infancy. And we are all something the cosmos is doing. Just like the water is waving and the wind is blowing, the whole wind is blowing, but it blows through this window and that.